anti-terror laws. I actually got into a discussion in some detail with a previous guest of mine who's quite well known, the barrister Frank McGuinness. Obviously, you're someone who's had this direct experience of these laws, which many would argue, and I certainly would argue, have been weaponized against you and others. You know, the whole modern concept of so-called terrorism, I think, has always been very problematic. But it seems to be the case now that terrorism, more blatantly than ever, just means behavior that the state doesn't like. And I think that has really increased, in particular, over the last sort of year or two. But surely that can't be sustainable. I mean, would you say that British society is going to reach breaking point over this? And how far do you think the government can really go in terms of continuously expanding this notion of terrorism and applying it against ordinary people?
I don't know how far it will go. And I don't know what the intention of it. I know that there is, well, when you're talking with young people, you know, people who say, oh, I'd never ring 999 anymore. I'd ring for a taxi to come and help me, but I'd never ring the police. I boycott Crime Stoppers. I don't have anything to do with the police any longer. Even very conservative, if you like, people that have been burgled, they've lost an awful lot of money. They own large properties. And the police have turned up sort of 4 weeks after the 999 call and said, we can't be bothered. Just go through your insurance. So what concerns me, I guess, and I know that nobody likes Douglas Murray, and I do get that, but he did. He was the one that did a bit of research and found out that the police hadn't actually solved any crime or burglary crime in the north for over a year. And it's purely because what they're doing is arresting people who aren't criminals. They're arresting people for voicing their opinion about the Israeli genocide. Anyone that supports Palestine, anyone that supports Gaza, anyone that knows anybody in Palestine or anybody reporting the news or, you know, who's got a public platform, they now are the ones who are criminalised. So on meeting a burglar in a pub a few months back, he actually said, it's my most lucrative time. I can now burgle houses and the police don't give a damn. Now, there's a truth in that. They don't have time for crime any longer, but what they do have time for is protecting the Israeli state and protecting the Israeli genocide and protecting the government's very deep-rooted complicity in the genocide. So that's all they're working for now. They're just working to protect the Israeli regime. So everything else now, like I say, you make a 999 call, it'll take them 4 weeks to arrive, certainly in our area. And then if you're lucky, you'll get a text message saying, sorry, you've been a victim of crime. Then you'll never hear anything ever again. So I don't actually know where the police think that they're going on this. They're certainly turning the hearts and minds of people that have probably been quite supportive of the police away. They're stopping, young children don't want to ring 99 anymore. Parents aren't telling the kids to ring 99 in case the kids get taken away. There's this sort of fear, terror, that the police now are no longer working for us, but they're working for the Israeli regime. And they're doing it through the government, the British government, which is now so tightly like melted in to the regime that they're facilitating the genocide. They're selling them weapons. We're even hosting the Israeli weapons factories. We are trading like never before. Yeah, they made that 30%. They cut out 30% of the arms that they were sending over to Israel. But it's probably a few wires and a few soundboards and a few things like this. But the majority of the drones are made here. The majority of the fleet, we're still making helicopter parts, Merkava tank, air conditioning parts. We're still trading with the Israelis to make sure that this genocide can continue. We're still sending them weapons. So, we've got to a stage where our government's no longer working for us. The police aren't working for us. I'm concerned that the judicial system is not working for us as well. I don't know what will happen with these 2,000 people. Will they just acquit them? Will they drop the charges? Will they continue to harass them? Will there be more home raids? This is fascism, and it's crept into our lives without us really noticing, to the point now where, you know, you have to lock your door every time you go out. You have to have a double lock on your door now when you go out. You know, you have to hide your devices. You have to turn things off. You have to make sure your PIN numbers are changed. You have to make sure everything is encrypted. It's like we've become paranoid of people that used to once serve us or used to once protect the communities. They no longer do that. They're becoming our enemies. And I don't know where that leads. I don't know what the pushback will be, but there will be one. There will be one.
Well, thank you very much for that, Sarah. I'm afraid that we have run out of time for part one of the program, so we're going to have to pause our conversation there. But we'll be back with part two of Attrition before too long. See you next time.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Next to the conscientious objector's commemorative stone, a demonstration rooted in conscience. Demonstrators, some from other parts of Europe, defying the elements and threats of arrest, holding placards that have become symbols of nonviolent action.
What people here are doing and what the widespread wave of civil disobedience that we've started with Defend Our Juries is against the prescription of Palestine Action. And that prescription, which is now being challenged in the High Court next week, is basically what we're arguing, that it is unjust, it's immoral, and it should have never happened. And it is really a breach of everyone's civil liberties. It is really an attack on democracy.
Before long come the arrests. Since these protests first began in the summer, British police have arrested more than 2,000, charging hundreds under terror laws in a move the demonstrators say is to stifle dissent against the UK's complicity in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians.
They've attempted to use terrorism legislation to remove from all public discourse the one body of people in this country who, as citizens, have stood up and put their bodies on the line to materially interrupt an economic, military, and diplomatic collaboration in genocide.
Palestine Action was prescribed by former Home Secretary Yvette Cooper in June this year. Membership of or support for the group is punishable by up to 14 years in prison.
The government is complicit in the genocide in Gaza, and they will do anything to criminalize any resistance against it, including old people sat with signs saying, "I oppose genocide."
In an unprecedented move in British history, Palestine Action is challenging its prescription in this court starting November 25th in the form of a judicial review.
If the High Court votes in favor of Palestine Action, the thousands of arrests and the hundreds of charges that were brought against demonstrators like these under the Terrorism Act of 2000 will also be quashed.
A victory for Palestine Action would also have repercussions for its jailed members, six of whom are now on an open-ended hunger strike in prisons across Britain. Cyprus is London.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The third and fourth floors of a nine-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. Deputy head of Hezbollah Political Bureau confirmed to Press TV that a senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are two potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In September this year, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced his government's plans to introduce mandatory digital ID for all British citizens by 2029. The announcement sparked fury across the full spectrum of the British political landscape, uniting forces who would otherwise disagree on pretty much everything else. The digital ID's plans have led to continuous protests, with thousands braving wintry weather conditions in London on Saturday to express their opposition to the plans.
We're here to protest digital ID. We're also here to make the point to people that they're already being tracked, they're already being surveilled and controlled by systems beyond their knowledge or control. And this is just an extra step. And this is almost a way for the government to act like we're giving our consent for them to track us. But they're doing it anyway.
Today, the main justification given by Starmer for the rollout of digital IDs is to help the government's crackdown on illegal migration, leading to suspicions that the so-called migrant crisis was allowed to develop to then justify these types of draconian measures in response.
A massive fear that many Brits have is that the digital ID plans, in combination with a rumoured ban on the use of cash in the future, portends the creation of a dystopian AI-powered control grid where every move you make is subject to surveillance and censorship by the state in real time.
These protesters believe that enough of the country is opposed to the digital ID rollout, but that for mass non-compliance to become a realistic prospect, unity across the political spectrum is a must.
Anybody organising anything can be controlled by this. So we want everyone to unite in common cause. As you say in our leaflet here, Palestine and freedom fighters, indeed everyone, unite in common cause.
The British state has long wanted to introduce digital IDs, going as far back as when Tony Blair floated the prospect when he was Prime Minister in the 2000s. But with mass opposition already forming and one of the most unpopular governments in recent history at the helm, opponents are quietly confident in their chances of defeating the entire idea altogether. Peace Academy, London.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity, or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Yemen.
Ireland's health minister, Ali Shayban, paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The latest U.S. jobs reports paints a bleak portrait of the American economy under President Donald Trump. Newly released data showed the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% in September, its highest level since October 2021, signaling a labor market losing momentum. Industries once considered pillars of the American economy are faltering. Transportation and warehousing shed more than 25,000 jobs, while manufacturing lost another 6,000 positions. The report itself was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption triggered by political brinkmanship in Washington. Its release now lands alongside troubling inflation data. Manual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming that prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. Economists point to one major culprit behind rising costs: Trump's aggressive and increasingly erratic tariff regime. Since returning to office, he has slapped steep import taxes on goods from dozens of countries, including long-standing allies. Instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Trump had promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. Instead, a clear majority now report that their expenses have surged. Despite Trump's repeated insistence that there is virtually no inflation, a new Harris poll shows Americans continuing to feel financial strain and growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. The data underscore their frustration. The typical American household now spends $208 more every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier, and more than $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the nation was emerging from the pandemic. Now, many analysts believe that if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies, the financial pressure will only spread. Higher prices, fewer job opportunities, and a shrinking margin of stability for millions of households already stretched thin.
Thank you. news related to the Group of Seven is always controversial. At the annual meetings of the seven industrial nations, important issues are discussed. Topics such as political decisions, economic problems, and climate challenges. These countries, which control 60% of the world's economy, seek solutions to crises that threaten not only their own populations, but the lives of all inhabitants of the planet. For this reason, the G7 summit carries great significance for news agencies and scientific circles. Months in advance, experts and journalists propose subjects to draw the attention of policymakers. The events of 2013 were of this same nature, a year in which the G7 summit differed markedly from previous years. Given the circumstances of that time, it would not have been surprising if experts had recommended focusing on climate change, the economic crisis following 2008, or the Syrian war and the rise of Daesh, but that was not the case. For example, one British expert took a different stance. Professor Sally Davis, the UK government's health advisor, released a striking report, a report she considered more important than terrorism or climate change. The subject of her report was antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In a stark warning, Davis declared, "Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is like a ticking time bomb." When Hitler spread the flames of war across Europe, countless soldiers were sent to the front. Many were transferred to field hospitals, where doctors once again relived the bitter memories of the First World War. The infected wounds of thousands of soldiers had to be treated, not only to save their lives, but because politicians needed every single one of them to secure victory in the war. The only thing that could meet this need was antibiotics, and the only entities capable of producing them in vast quantities were governments. The warring states pressured pharmaceutical companies, and the process of antibiotic production began. The process, by keeping human forces alive, was able to change the course of the war. In the mid-20th century, just before antibiotics were mass-produced for humans, another development occurred. Researchers announced that this drug could first and foremost transform food production and human food security. Until then, the production of food products was not subject to specific health regulations. And in some countries, traditional methods of production meant that bacteria entered the human body along with food. The discovery of antibiotics changed this process, and researchers proposed their use in the livestock and poultry industry. The industry for years had struggled with widespread animal deaths and diseases, problems that limited meat production and kept its price high. But antibiotics worked like a miracle.
That most farms won't let cameras in. But one in North Georgia agreed, as long as we didn't reveal its name.
What's your big goal?
The farm's veterinarian, Chuck Hoffaker, showed me how antibiotics have become essential to industrial-scale farming.
My big goal is to prevent disease.
It is like a small city, isn't it?
Yes, because once they get sick, just as in a city, the disease can then spread through the population fairly quickly.
This is what Hoffaker wants to prevent.
This chicken was sick because of an intestinal disease.
So this is a signal to you that time to use an antibiotic to prevent this from spreading.
That's correct.
Chuck, what do we have here?
Well, this is an antibiotic called lincomycin.
Antibiotics like this are regularly put in the drinking water or added to the feed of healthy animals, most of the time without a prescription.
Empty the antibiotic into the water. Water coming out of this bucket with the antibiotic will be injected into their water, and then that water will then go on into the chicken house and will be at the proper dosage.
It's estimated that as much as 70% of all antibiotics sold in the United States go to farms.
They drink out of these nipples, and they eat from these feeders, and that helps the flock grow better. The farmer does better because they have more pounds of meat, give the consumer a cheaper food supply. The chickens are healthier, so healthy chickens mean a healthier product for the consumer as well.
But increasingly, this widespread use of antibiotics in animals has been raising concerns.
Is it possible that there's a pathway? I'm thinking particularly of resistance, you know. Could it go in bugs from the chicken house to the family table?
We don't know how often that occurs. We think that it probably occurs at a very, very low rate.
Sally Davis's recommendation to the leaders of the G7 about the current state of humanity pointed precisely to this issue: bacterial resistance to antibiotics. She considered the crisis to consist of two main parts: direct consumption and indirect consumption. From Davis's remarks, it was clear that the meat reaching people was saturated with antibiotics, drugs administered either by injection or through feed, which soon entered the human stomach along with the meat. The crisis that had emerged in the livestock industry was, in fact, a crisis for human bodies as well. The meat was contaminated with bacteria that no antibiotic could destroy. Bacteria transmitted directly into humans. Yet this was only one side of the coin. Figures like Davis believed the greater danger lay in direct consumption of antibiotics, a widespread practice whose statistics grew daily. A mistaken belief persisted in popular culture that antibiotics were harmless and always healing. Patients were pleased if they could persuade doctors to prescribe the drug, and if not, they resorted to self-medication. Britain's Public Health Agency reports that in the industrial nation alone, more than 20% of antibiotic prescriptions are unnecessary. Globally, the figure ranges between 30 and 50%. The unnecessary prescriptions made Davis's crisis appear all more serious: the crisis of antibiotic resistance. Meat saturated with antibiotics, excessive prescriptions, and self-medication form the three sides of the crisis, a dangerous, deadly triangle for the inhabitants of Earth. With each passing day, bacteria grow more resistant to antibiotics. At present, 2 million people each year suffer infections solely because bacteria have become resistant. In England, 7% of annual deaths are due to infections. Simple infections that half a century ago would have been eliminated by a basic antibiotic, but which now have become a serious threat. A threat that, it is said, will be more dangerous than cancer by 2050.
I first heard about David's case in July of 2011. I was sitting in my office doing some work, and one of my colleagues, an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Doug Smith, gave me a call and asked me if I'd known about a patient up on one of our acute care floors with a number of drug-resistant pathogens. I brought up his medical record and saw a huge amount of drug resistance we don't typically see
All these R's mean that the bacteria is resistant to that antibiotic.
I get this knock on my door, and they open up the door, and there's these doctors. They tell me, we need to isolate you. We need to put you on your own and quarantine you.
Drug-resistant bacterial infections are on track to kill more people than cancer.
By 2050, superbugs could kill 10 million people a year.
Now we are seeing bacteria that are resistant to the absolute last stop on the train, colistin. And so for those patients, there are no options left. So those patients are truly have gone back in time. They are back in the pre-antibiotic era, and they will recover from those infections or will die from those infections, and there's nothing we can do for them.
We may reach a point where no antibiotic is effective even against the simplest infections. We may return to the conditions before the 20th century, and history may repeat itself. This was precisely Davis's warning that carried a troubling question. She emphasized that for 25 years, no new antibiotic had been developed, a strange fact that directly targeted pharmaceutical companies. The reason for this is not very complicated. Although antibiotic consumption is high, the crucial issue is the enormous cost of developing one. Estimates suggest that if a company wants to create a new antibiotic, it must spend around $1.5 billion, while its annual market sales would yield only about $50 million in profit. For the past three decades, pharmaceutical companies have refused to produce antibiotics for purely financial reasons. They prefer to invest their money in other products. Each year, their research and development divisions introduce new cosmetic drugs. Botox compounds, baldness treatments, prosthetics, bodybuilding hormones, and vitamins. The funds that could have gone into antibiotic development are instead spent on such items. The few drugs that are produced are not created with therapeutic goals in mind, but with the same profit-driven approach. The development of diabetes and blood pressure medications has only one reason. Unlike antibiotics, these drugs must be taken daily and for the patient's entire lifetime, creating an industry that guarantees long-term revenue for companies. That is why pharmaceutical corporations have no answer to the concern of critics. It is said that one of the main ways to confront the current crisis is to develop new antibiotics. But this is not something that the owners of pharmaceutical companies are willing to accept. They prefer to think of their own profits rather than the consequences of their actions. The consequences became more evident than ever in 2020, a tense year that confirmed the truth of earlier warnings.
Sense that you have to make some very ruthless decisions about where to put the company's capital, about where to invest, where to put your emphasis. And when you pulled out of gram-negative research like that and shifted to vaccines, do you look back on that and say, you know, we learned something about this?
These are not ruthless decisions. These are, you know, portfolio decisions about how we can serve medical need in the best way. We want to stay, you know, in the business of providing new therapeutics for the future. Our investors require that of us. I think society wants a Pfizer to be doing what we do in 20 years. We make portfolio management decisions.
There is an increasing recognition that antibiotics are not a good thing to run off a pure capitalistic market, okay? We need to switch from an entrepreneurial business model where you maximize sales to other payer mechanisms where the goal is society can say, we want these kinds of antibiotics developed, and we're going to help you out. We're going to decrease your cost and risk. In return, on the back end, we're going to have some say in how it's used so it doesn't get abused.
When news arrived that a strange virus had spread from Wuhan, China, no one imagined what would happen in the weeks ahead. At first, COVID-19 was not taken seriously. Yet, within just 3 months, it placed the busiest cities in the world under total quarantine. The global economy faced crisis, and one social upheaval after another became apparent. There was no clear prospect for vaccine development, and politicians tried to speculate about the origin of the virus. Although the source of COVID-19 remains uncertain, transmission from animals to humans is considered one of the serious hypotheses. Some link it to human interference in the environment, while others believe its spread resembles that of SARS, MERS, and Ebola, dangerous viruses that in recent decades have disrupted the course of human life. Precisely at a time when no new antibiotic had been developed and the overuse of existing drugs had peaked, the outbreak of COVID-19 and the investigation into its origin provided an excuse for the issue of superbugs to resurface. Bacteria that, through continuous mutations, have gained strength and rendered all existing antibiotics ineffective. These bacteria, expected to grow even more powerful in the years ahead, may become a serious threat to the future of humanity. As Davis had said back in 2013, resistance to antibiotics will be even more dangerous than terrorism, something like a ticking time bomb, predicted to claim one life every 3 seconds. COVID-19 was a wake-up call that made the importance of this bomb clearer, a bomb that humanity has little time to defuse. Experts have offered crucial recommendations for the time remaining so that the experience of COVID-19 will not be repeated. Confronting superbugs requires cooperation among politicians, the medical community, and the people of the world. Governments must invest in the development of new antibiotics in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies. Passing laws to reduce the use of these drugs in the livestock industry is the next step. The medical community must minimize antibiotic prescriptions so that they can regain their original effectiveness. Changing the culture of medicine among humans is also one of the most important conditions for overcoming the crisis. People's attitudes toward antibiotics and their use must change. The belief that all illnesses can be cured with this drug is a mistaken notion of recent decades, a belief that new experiments have proven false.
Dr. Chris Wired is one of the last working ethnopharmacologists, who are scientists who go into the wilderness to look for plants that can be turned into medically viable drugs in humans' ongoing war against disease.
The last hope for human race survival, I believe, is in the rainforest of tropical Asia. The pharmaceutical wealth of this land is immense. A jungle is not a peaceful environment. Trees fight with trees. Trees fight with insects. They all fight and communicate, and they use chemicals, and we are looking for those chemicals. But we have no time. What could happen if we've got major pandemias, millions of deaths? This is no joke. It is now or never. We don't break it, right?
Right, yeah. Just bow it.
We just bow that guy. Slow, slow, slow. Okay, that's great. Can someone take a piece off the stem there?
Just very carefully taking some branches off a tree.
in hopes of curing mankind of disease.
Okay, can I have that guy here? All right. Okay, we've got something interesting here. This is an absolute sign of Rubiaceae family. Mm-hmm. That plant contains alkaloid. That one is a very rare one. We're going to make some collections of that guy. My sixth sense to me is we've got something.
Yeah.
That's a great time we've done.
Have you seen this plant before?
Never.
In the jungle?
Yeah,
no,
never.
This is the first time.
That's a good one.
Wow.
Wonderful.
The book Bald's Leech Book proved that the way to fight bacteria was the same old method. By turning to this manuscript, doctors were able to arrive at a new combination for a plant-based antibiotic, a potent remedy that, as in the past, could eliminate infections. They continue to recommend the development of new antibiotics and the reduction of current drug use, but their new outlook is a return to nature. Now there is talk of antibiotic properties of algae, as well as discussions about the therapeutic effects of honey and its potential as a substitute for synthetic drugs. These are natural methods of escaping the antibiotic trap, a drug that not long ago was humanity's bait for hunting bacteria, but has now become a trap of death, a trap as numerous as the inhabitants of the earth.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148.